In the episode today, we're going to talk about police brutality, and our discussions may include depictions of violence and sexual violence perpetrated by police. So use discretion when listening.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, what is a police brutality? Or what is police brutality?
Yeah, what is police brutality?
Welcome and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Tymie. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We're glad you're here. So, Tymie, I have a question for you today.
Okay.
So, imagine that you are pulled over by the police.
Okay.
And
I have been pulled over by the police. Yeah.
And you kind of get a little mouthy with the officers.
Okay.
And they drag you out of the car and beat the snot out of you.
Okay.
And you want to sue the police officers for violating your rights. So you're going to sue them for police brutality.
Okay.
Which of your constitutional rights would the police have violated by brutalizing you?
Okay, let me think about this. What about Amendment 3, the Third Amendment?
I don't even know what that one is. Is that the quartering of soldiers? No, it would not be the quartering of soldiers.
Okay, that one doesn't apply. Maybe the Fifth Amendment, because you have deprived me of my liberty, life liberty.
No, not number five. It's not number five either.
Okay. I don't know.
You might be tempted to say the Eighth Amendment. Because you get beat up and you think that it's cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah.
But police use of force is not a punishment. The police should not be using force to punish people because to be punished, you have to be found guilty of a crime.
Right.
So police use of force is not a punishment. Police use force to control or to protect.
Okay, got it.
And that is the not punishment to control and protect.
Okay, good.
And police use of force is considered a seizure of person. So Fourth Amendment.
Okay.
Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. When police use force, violence, brutality, that's considered a seizure of person.
So they have seized my person.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. So you've used a lot of terms here, right? Brutality,
yep.
Force, excessive force. Can you please break those down for us and the listener?
Yeah, good question. So first we need to talk about the police and the police use of force. So the police are the only individuals, entities in society that can use force, and force is a more general way to talk about violence. So the police can legitimately use violence.
We cannot.
To get us to do what they want us to do. Yes, we cannot. I have argued that professors should also have that ability. I think my job would be much more effective and fun if I could tase students, but nobody...
Get those taser knuckles from the real-life superheroes.
Yeah, I can't get anybody to agree with me.
Yeah.
But police are the only individuals who can use force, and we think of it as a social contract. So we give up our right to protect ourselves and our right to, you know, feudal vengeance in exchange for the police protecting us. In exchange for us giving up our rights, the police use that power, only should use that power when it's reasonable, proportional, and necessary.
Right. So, okay. So as part of the social contract, the police represent the state, and they have a monopoly on the use of violence, and they're the only agency or institution that we give the power to beat us up.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So legitimate force, reasonable force, the minimum amount of force that's necessary to control a situation. And police are trained on a use of force continuum, which is a tool that teaches police officers how to match the level of force that they use on a suspect with the actions presented by the suspect.
Okay.
So if a suspect, they pull someone over and they're cooperative and compliant, then there's no need to use force or violence. In research on police use of force indicates that overall it's pretty statistically rare, so only about 1.5% of police citizen encounters involve police use of force. In when police do use force, it's more likely to be at the lower end of the continuum. So those things like hands-on tactics and less lethal weapons and technologies.
So where does that number come from? the 1.5% of police citizen encounters involve use of force. Is that from police reports?
No, it's from research. So
research,
yes.
Okay.
I can't cite the exact article off the top of my head, but my professor, okay. Jeff Alpert from University of South Carolina, was a policing scholar expert, yeah. And that comes from some of his research and writing. That's
not
a police.
So he did talk to people and get, mm-hmm. information from people in the community. Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay.
So excessive force then is when police use more force than is necessary. Mm-hmm. So when they, go above the level of resistance or threat posed by the suspect.
Got it.
And excessive force is evaluated, again, based on the Fourth Amendment, but the legal standard of excessive force is referred to as objective reasonableness.
Okay.
So excessive force is when police use more force than is necessary. And then we can recognize deadly force. And deadly force is force that is capable of or has the potential to kill.
Right.
That does not mean that somebody has to die.
Right.
So deadly force, police can use deadly force against somebody and they can survive.
Yes.
It only has to be capable of killing. But guns, firearms, definitely deadly force. And any time a police officer uses a firearm, that's considered deadly force, whether they, hit the person that they're shooting at or miss them or hit them and they die or hit them and they don't die. But, guns are always considered, firearms are always considered deadly force because they have the potential to kill someone.
Yeah.
So, like, the scenario that we see in TV and movies where a police officer shoots the gun out of a suspect's hand or shoots the tires out of a car or, like, shoots them in the shoulder.
Yeah.
So, that is a exaggerated, fictitious scenario. That
really?
Yeah. Police should not be using their guns.
To shoot at people.
To shoot at people unless they have grounds to take someone's life.
Yeah.
But other things besides guns can be considered deadly force. Things like choke holds, baton strikes to the head, hitting suspects with their vehicle. And I mentioned before, the fact that police use of firearms doesn't have to kill someone to be considered deadly force. Research indicates that suspects who are shot at by police are only hit between 30 to 50% of the time. And the number of fatalities of police shootings at suspects may be as low as 15%.
Wow.
So most of the people that police actually end up shooting at don't die.
Okay.
And that only makes them slightly more effective than stormtroopers in terms of hitting their mark.
Oh, God.
Only Imperial stormtroopers could be so precise. But one of the big problems in relation to police use of force and police deadly force in particular is that historically we've not had good data about the number of people killed by police officers. And in fact, after Ferguson, the Washington Post began collecting data, and there was another source on police data mapping police violence. But anyway, those data sources indicated that we were underestimating the number of people killed by police officers by half or three quarters.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Mapping Police Violence Project, which I'll link to in the show notes, it does a better job than the Washington Post data. And they have the information on the website about how they collect the data, so it's more expansive, it's more comprehensive. And they found that in 2022, police killed at least 1,195 people, and that's more than what the Washington Post data has listed. So some other facts, black people are three times more likely than white people to be killed. But those numbers are much larger in the major cities. So in a major city, that might be 26 times, like in, mm-hmm. for example, in Chicago. Black people are 1.3 times more likely to be unarmed than white people. And more black and brown people were more likely to be killed while fleeing. So these are just some of the facts from this database here. Mm-hmm. So a couple of other interesting tidbits while we're talking about this. Most killings began with traffic stops, mental health checks, non-violent offenses, and where no crime was alleged. So only about 1 in 3 of these incidents began with mm-hmm. an alleged violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
So they also challenge some of the other data that we have on most police shootings being of someone who was armed. So they use the category allegedly armed to challenge those figures. But they separately also include vehicle as a weapon. Mm-hmm. So that mm-hmm. is not in the Washington Post data as well, where mm-hmm. vehicle is a weapon. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the reasons for this is because of something, an example of what just came out this week alone. There were two cases of police showing up to the wrong address, one case in Alabama and one in Massachusetts. They were both domestic violence calls. They went to the wrong address and killed both people who answered the door, essentially. Mm. But the reason I mention this is because the one individual who somebody's knocking on his door at 11:30 at night showed up to the door with a gun. And so because he was shot and killed in that incident, that would be included in the statistics of they shot him and he was armed. So, drilling down a little bit into the details, you find out that the stories, you know, have a little bit more information in there that you know. I guess the only other thing I want to mention here from, because I just looked at this today, so I just wanted to give the most updated figures. This year, so far, police have already killed 293 people. And this is on par with last year. And last year, police killed more people than any year in the past decade. So that's just something I wanted to share from the project database.
When you look at, you know, the data that's been collected since, you know, 2015 or 2014, the number of police killed by police increases slightly, marginally each year, but it's been 1,000 plus.
Yeah, yeah, correct.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about police officers killed, when we compare that to police officers killed in the line of duty, the FBI collects the law enforcement officers killed in action data published every year. 2019 is the last year published on the FBI website at this point, but looking at those data, on average, between 40 to 55 officers are killed feloniously each year by suspects. 2019, it was 48 compared to 1,000-plus people that officers kill a year.
Right.
And finally, we get to the topic of our episode, brutality.
Yeah, we took so maybe we should call this episode something else and then do another episode on.
I think to understand brutality, you also kind of have to understand, you know, the pretext and the use of violence by police more broadly.
Yes.
But brutality is different from excessive force because policing scholars have argued that brutality particularly connotes a conscious and a deliberate dimension. That police excessive force is when police go too far, and brutality is when police go too far on purpose.
Yes. Mm. Okay.
So police brutality is when police are intentionally, purposefully trying to use force, use violence to hurt, to punish suspects, to teach a lesson.
Right.
So in the scenario that I mentioned up front, like you were getting mouthy with the police officers, if police officers are beating you up because you disrespected them or, you know, because you mouthed off to them, that's not a legitimate use of force, and that's more than police just using more force than they should. That is brutality, using force to punish you. One of the clearest examples of police brutality that I've ever encountered happened in 1997. In a man named Abner Luema, who was an immigrant from Haiti, he was visiting a New York nightclub. A fight broke out. Officers responded. One of the officers was essentially standing in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And he was sucker punched from behind, and he turned around. And he thought Mr. Luema had done it, but he actually wasn't the one who punched him.
Right.
But he thought it was. He was punched from behind. So he arrested him, took him back to the precinct. Mr. Luema was beaten badly, and then he was taken to a bathroom and sodomized with a broken broom handle.
Yeah.
His teeth were then damaged when the broom handle was forced into his throat.
Horrific.
And his internal injuries required 3 surgeries to correct. He was hospitalized for 2 months after the attack. The officer ended up receiving 30 years without parole. But, you know, that's violent, that's brutal. There's no legitimate reason for any type of use of police violence force. And that was, you know, was a clear the officer, you hit me, so I'm going to teach you a lesson for hitting me.
It was more than just retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was torture.
Brutalization. In my ethics class, we talk about, evaluating ethical police use of force as a narrower lens to look through than the legality. We talked about the Supreme right. Court. And one of the factors that we mentioned, or that I mentioned there, is you know, force that is unseemly or shocking to the conscience.
Yeah.
And that is an example of something that's shocking, that's clearly unseemly. On a side note, funny story about this. On one of my ethics exams, you know, I had a question asking about ethical police use of force.
Yeah.
And one of the students' answers on that said, well, police use of force is unethical when police knock you unconscious. And I read that and I was scratching my head and I was like, like, maybe, but also maybe like legitimate force could knock. So I couldn't figure out where that came from.
Yeah.
But the student was mixing up, shocking to the conscience, your Jiminy Cricket, right and wrong, with consciousness. So they thought shocking to the conscience meant when police knocked you unconscious.
Oh my God, that's so good.
But anyway, back to serious topics. I think, you know, we're all familiar with the George Floyd incident in 2020.
Yes.
And most people would recognize that that also is more than just police using more force than is necessary.
Correct.
Particularly given Officer Chauvin's past history of complaint, misconduct, witness testimony that he frequently choked suspects, knelt on their necks, that he liked to escalate incidents, he liked to tussle.
Right.
He didn't like people to challenge his authority.
Yeah.
Another recent example that's been in the news lately is Tyre Nichols out of Memphis. And, you know, this goes back to the situation that you mentioned earlier, that a lot of the precursors to these police shootings are police pulling people over.
Yes.
So they pulled him over. They pulled him out of a vehicle, and this is all on film. They threatened him with a taser, pointed a gun at him, pushed him to the ground. He gets up and he runs away from that, and they chase him and they catch him, and then two police officers hold him. He's kicked in the head, he's punched in the face, he's beaten with a baton, he's pepper sprayed, and he eventually died of his injuries.
Yes.
So, like, you know, police holding someone down and kicking them in the face, punching them in the head, that's, you know, not types of force that police should be using, and
right.
that's more than just police going too far. That's police brutality.
Yeah, so in all of the examples, the victims of police brutality were all black men. How does the race of the individual affect police brutality?
Well, you know, we know from research and statistics that people of color are more likely to experience police use of force, more likely to be killed by the police, and particularly more likely to be unjustifiably killed by the police. So this isn't an episode on racial bias in policing, but it is worth mentioning that racism and bias in policing results in people of color being more likely to experience police force in brutality.
Yeah.
And again, oftentimes unjustifiably so.
Yes.
So when we think about, you know, racism and implicit bias in particular, these types of, you know, biases may lead people, mainly police officers particularly, to see people of color as more threatening, as more aggressive, as, you know, their conduct as more, you know, criminal and, you know, unjustifiable compared to white individuals. And also, you know, there have been, you know, lots of research evidence that indicates that, you know, a bias that people have is that, or that police officers have in particularly, is that, you know, individuals of color are more likely to be armed with a weapon.
Yeah.
And incorrectly so.
Okay. So in terms of training, I bring up this question, how do we train or, you know, reform the police? What police reform often talks about technocratic solutions, things like body cams. Just a little bit on police training. People have to keep in mind that we have over 18,000 individual independent police agencies in the United States. And so there's no standardized training. And studies have shown that in every state in the U.S., individuals who are studying cosmetology, which is, if you don't know, hair, learning how to, like, cut hair, you know, color hair, that kind of thing.
Yeah, my sister has her cosmetology license.
In every state in the U.S., you receive more in-class hours and apprentice hours than you do for law enforcement training.
You're kidding.
It's a pretty low standard for law enforcement training. So there's no standardized training. And we have so many, you know, in fact, in rural agencies, they get even less training. They're not even likely to have gone to a police academy. So what do we do?
Well, I mean, before we think about, you know, specific areas of improvement for training, we should think about increasing the amount of training that is required for police officers.
Quantity also.
Yeah, and I know in, you know, in Virginia that you can, you know, work as a police officer on the road, I think, for a year before you even have to go to police academy.
Yeah, and in other countries, they receive a lot more training, a lot more in-class hours, a lot more overall. You know, in some European countries, 2 to 3 years is what you are required to do before you can become a police officer.
But other than just, you know, increasing the required hours of training, body cams are frequently, you know, posited as an easy solution. But research shows that, you know, they're not super effective at reducing, you know, police use of force and complaints. There's mixed evidence, but overall not much of an effect because, you know, obviously policies across departments are different, but many officers have discretion when they can turn their cameras on and off. Cameras, we think of them as kind of like objective records of what happened, but they can also kind of show distorted pictures. A lot of times you can look at body cam footage and not really, you can't see everything and you don't know the full story and you don't know what's going on. And then we've also recognized that they actually may not deter bad behavior. So the Tyree Nichols case, you know,
there was
body cam, the body cams were on for that. Yeah, another important area of increased training may be recognizing and training officers to recognize the impacts of physiological stress and bodily reactions to stress.
Right.
So, you know, there have been, you know, scholars who have suggested that, you know, police training should, you know, kind of like prime police officers to get in that fight or flight mode. You know, how you feel like when you're like startled and woken awake and the adrenaline pumping and blood pumping and your vision is restricted.
Right.
That's kind of like the fight or flight. So use heart rate monitors and other means and mechanisms to, you know, train police officers on using skills in decision-making and de-escalation when they're experiencing these physiological symptoms of stress.
Yes.
And along those lines, de-escalation training, you know, emphasizing that police officers should be trying to de-escalate, to take a situation from serious to less serious.
Yeah, and lower often, the temperature, not increase it.
Right. So, you know, oftentimes police use of force is an escalation, that it, you know, it doesn't calm things down. It increases the, the, you know, tenseness and level of a situation. Addressing racial bias in policing, and this is still something that, you know, we're struggling with. Scientifically, implicit bias training, the studies on implicit bias training haven't shown them to be really effective.
Right.
Or that the effects might be short-lived there, that there might be kind of an immediate effect on, you know, bias in police decision-making, but that that kind of wears off after time.
Correct.
Another important, you know, policy recommendation is to collect national use of force data. We have the, you know, Police Violence Project and the Washington Post data, but those are, you know, independent data collection agency. There's no central reporting of you know, police force. And again, those databases are just people killed by police, and we know that police deadly force is more than just people killed. And obviously, the police use, the majority of the force that police use is non-lethal force.
Yeah.
So having, you know, good data on police use of force.
So one project that the Mapping Police Violence Project, one of their projects in this larger project is called the Police Scorecard. And they document as much information as they can on police departments around the United States. So they collect data and rank departments, with higher scores being given to departments that use less force, make fewer arrests for low-level offenses, solve murder cases more often, and hold officers more accountable. So in those lists, a major city like Chicago is going to be number 500, you know, like where they're among the worst offenders. But then, you know, toward the top of the list where departments do those things well, you know, Chesapeake, Virginia is at like number 23. So at the top of the list. So, yeah, so we just, to that, we don't have a lot of data, right? So we're kind of counting on these independent projects because police don't usually keep misconduct and brutality data on themselves as agencies. And so we have to rely on these independent institutions.
So to close our show, it's our Minute Spin It, where we each give our 30-second takeaway from today's show. So Timing. In just a minute, what's your spin? Or are you declining to spin
today? I'm going to decline to spin today just because I want to just sort of highlight the fact that you introduced a lot of concepts today that we discuss mm-hmm. with students. And we just didn't get into much detail about a lot of them. And I just want to acknowledge that this is a topic, you know, that does cause emotional distress in people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just feel like I don't really have a good spin today. Mm-hmm. I'll leave the funny mm-hmm. part to you. So what's your spin, babe?
My spin is that brutality is not just a fancy way to kill your opponent in Mortal Kombat, the video game.
Yes.
But...
hopefully our listeners know what Mortal Kombat is.
Hopefully. Police brutality is cruel, severe, and lacking any attempt to disguise unpleasantness.
This podcast is sponsored by the Gandhi Center at JMU. See our show notes for links to articles and studies discussed on the podcast, as well as the databases that we mentioned. Please help us decide what justice topics to cover by sending suggestions to gandhicenter@jmu.edu or DM us on Instagram @gandhicenterjmu.